Hello, and welcome to the Arrow Global Half-Year 2025 Results. My name is George, and I'll be your coordinator of today's event. Please note this call is being recorded, and for the duration of the call, your lines will be in a listen-only mode. However, you will have the opportunity to ask questions towards the end of the presentation, and this can be done by pressing star one on your telephone keypad to register your question. If you require assistance at any point, please press star zero, and you will be connected to an operator. On the call today, we have Zach Louis, Group Chief Executive Officer and Group Chief Investment Officer, and Phil Shepherd, Group Chief Financial Officer. I'm going to hand the call over to your host, Mr. Zach Louis, to begin today's conference. Over to you, Mr. Louis.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure to chat with you this morning. Looking at H1 2025, we made good progress down very similar strategic and execution lines of recent calls. As you see, the headline figure that really led the way this quarter was the $3.1 billion of trailing 12 months deployment. As you know, that was our medium-term target. We've been able to achieve that stronger level of deployment through two key factors. Firstly, ALO is now, for those who don't know, Arrow Lending Opportunities, our commingled lending franchise, which hereafter we'll call ALO. ALO was in full deployment mode, obviously, as a first-time commingled fund, now comfortably over $1 billion in size, that has strong capacity both to contribute and to recycle efficiently. And so we will continue to see strong deployment from that franchise. And secondly, we obviously benefited now from having a fully integrated Germany, France, and Spanish contribution to deal pipelines. That was not the case in the prior period. And so in the comparison of H1 2024 to H1 2025, Germany, France, and Spain being deployed and with good platforms in each place contributed to the progress in terms of deployment levels. Germany, in particular, had a strong 12 months, and the market opportunity there is very interesting, and our footprint on the ground is very effective. And so taking those together, that's been able to strengthen the deployment figure to hit our medium-term target in the last 12 months. As that $3.1 billion of trailing 12-month deployment flows through the system, you see that obviously leads to more NAV. NAV then leads to the management fees and servicing fees that drive the capital-light flywheel. That drove trailing 12-month IFM growth, which was $74.5 million in the first half of this year, 29% up on last year. We also had a strong performance on realizations, both in the funds and in the back book. So we were pleased to see that. We can chat later in the call on Q&A if people want about kind of the different market factors driving that. But in the ACO funds in particular, which is where a lot of the realizations occurred, you have the dynamic where ACO bought assets when interest rates were higher and discounts were lower back in 2023, 2024. And now that, particularly in the Eurozone, where rates have come down, a lot of those discounted purchases have refinanced away at higher levels, which has been both good for realizations and good for IRRs. Fund management assets have grown nicely at $10.7 billion now, up from just under $10 billion prior. Basically, that is the combination. Well, the significant majority of that is ALO fundraising that's come through, which is higher period on period. And the growth of ALO has exceeded what's gone back from ACO I, albeit that we'll talk about in the coming pages, have also accelerated recently. And obviously, that number will move up dramatically as we achieve the impending first close of ACO III. So moving to page four, you see how we run the business, which is, you know, as an asset manager, the three key pillars of our own financial performance is raising capital, investing capital, and realizing capital. On the raise side, ALO is now at $1.2 billion. We would expect the final close of ALO relatively shortly. That will go up nicely at final close and will be a very impressive first-time fund. We were pleased to have gotten a decent chunk of that fund to work when rates were higher. When that fund first started raising last year, and so investors are getting a good IRR outcome on that fund, and we'd expect that to be the start of a very strong franchise that builds, obviously, on the historical lending capability we have in Maslow and other Arrow platforms. On Invest, we've talked a lot about that already. You see, you know, particularly the Zygert deal that we announced recently has been a nice contributor in terms of German activity. We really have nicely balanced out the original Interboden platform we acquired in Dusseldorf with some useful additional pieces to that, which in this case are in Berlin, giving us closer to national coverage in Germany, alongside a couple other moves we've made that strengthened the German platform in a really constructive way. And as we look towards the second half of the year, which is cyclically usually quite strong, you know, we feel good about the continuing deployment pace. On realizations, ACL 1 had the notable progress. We sent back $135 million to investors over the last 3 months, taking the total distributions to date to $411 million. That's obviously good progress given the fund went into distribution period at the end of 23. So getting, you know, about 40% of the fund back already is good progress. Prior to that, all capital was recycled, which allowed us to deploy about 150% of the fund size. Similarly, on ACO2, we've made similar progress there. We've had an incredibly efficient quarter where deployments were strong, and so were realizations, and so we're able to basically drive that efficiency, taking total deployments to $3.8 billion, which against a $2.75 billion fund, which still has another about 9 months to go in its investment period, is a very efficient outcome set. IRRs there remain at 20% after servicing, and that effective recycling has led to good compounding, and both at the deal level and at the fund level, money multiples are about 0.3 above what our long-term track record is. Partly that's the benefit of deploying into a higher interest rate environment where deals are better situated. And part of that's the efficient recycling we've achieved from strong collections and strong deployment in a very effective way. So it's really more of the same in the sense that there's no new announcements today. It is just good deployment, good realizations, and good capital efficiency as we've driven that activity through the business, which is pleasing to see and has led to reasonable NAV growth and thereby reasonable FRE capture. As we move to page five, that's led to, I think, quite a mature version of our asset franchise. You know, as you see, we now cover Western Europe comfortably. That is really the success we're having in the investor marketplace, which is, you know, if you're a big institutional investor, which, as you'll know from prior calls, is our core client base, we really fulfill a key market segment, which is if you wanted a little bit of Europe, you could get that by, you know, obviously backing any of a number of global asset managers. If you want to get local in Europe, you really have two fundamental choices. You can work with someone like us who delivers, you know, 24 platforms in a single installation, or you'd have to go and do, you know, Italian bankruptcies with this manager and UK student housing with that manager and Portuguese mortgages with another manager. And most global institutional investors don't want to go effectively rebuild the footprint topography that we've done, where you obviously have to onboard lots of small country-specific or asset class-specific strategies, and by working with us to get, you know, 24 different local platforms, all of that origination, you know, now over $3 billion a year, from one single relationship done at the local level, that's an incredibly compelling value proposition for the global investor base. As you see on the left-hand side of the slide, that's allowed us to raise 6 billion euros into that franchise across our credit, lending, and real estate arms. And that product set, and I'd say generally with the U.S. tariff noise, certain geographies have turned very hard to Europe. I'd say investors for multiple cycles now have been underweight Europe in different asset classes, and now you see a catch-up occurring as some of the noise in the U.S. has led particular geographies to be very keen to rebalance and get to at least a normal weighting of Europe and correct the historical underweight, and that's been progress for us. That's played into our three discretionary funds. As you know from prior calls, we've got our three discretionary fund programs and then a few ancillaries and third-party servicing. It's nice to see the growth strongly in the discretionary fund categories. As we move to page six, you see our targets, which remain unchanged, driving 15 billion of AUM. Clearly, ACO 3 will shortly contribute substantially to the gap between our current 10.7 and that 15. The 3 billion per annum we've now achieved. We still leave that as our target. We'll review that over time as to now that we have all eight countries in Western Europe contributing and the multiple products, including ALO, where that can go in the future, but for now, that's the right target for over-the-cycle deployment. And then we've been growing NAV strongly, up 62%, as you see, and you'll see that continue to grow strongly as the products contribute nicely. Given we've been able to reduce our co-invest over time in the funds, the ROA on deployed capital goes up strongly. Phil can talk to that later in his section, and our leverage target remains unchanged as that capital light flywheel comes through, and the overhead costs have remained relatively stable quarter to quarter, albeit they're up on a year ago plus, given the fact that we had to build out the ALO capability and some of the fundraising capabilities. We carried that cost, and that cost is now obviously in situ and driving significant revenue. And so I think continuing to drive volume off this kind of installed cost base, which is quarter to quarter quite stable, will drive down the relative leverage position, as will the arrival of carry into the denominator. And so, yeah, it is a pretty steady, good progress in terms of core flywheel quarter. Obviously, the deployment is really the leading indicator of future NAV and all the fee capture. And so we're pleased with that progress and look forward to the second half. And with that, I'll pass to Phil for the more detailed financial review.
Thanks, Zach. Good morning, everyone. Slide 8 has the results for our integrated fund management segments, which includes the capitalized earnings from both our discretionary fund management and our third-party asset management activities. Total fee-related earnings grew 16% year-on-year to 38.5 million, with strong revenue growth at consistent margins. Revenues grew by 17% to 164.2 million, which comprises a 66% rise in the discretionary fund management revenues to 80.9 million, and a 9% fall in the third-party asset management revenues to 83.3 million. The decrease in third-party asset management revenue is driven by the switch in business from third-party clients to our discretionary funds with the launch of Arrow Lending Opportunities, ALO, in the second half of last year. In particular, a significant portion of revenues within Maslow, our UK lending platform, are now classified within the discretionary fund management business rather than third-party asset management. Despite the decrease compared with H1 2024, third-party asset management revenues have grown by 26% since H1 2023, in line with the guidance of revenue growing at a mid to high single-digit percentage per annum through the cycle. Slide 9 has further analysis on the performance of our discretionary fund management business, which includes the fees generated from both fund management and asset management and servicing activities provided to our discretionary funds, Arrow Credit Opportunities, ACO, our real estate fund, Arrow Real Estate Opportunities, AREO, and our lending fund, Arrow Lending Opportunities, ALO. The group primarily generates returns from deployed capital, with deployment of capital driving the growth in the NAV of the funds, which in turn drives the revenues, and the charts on slide 9 show the strong progression against these metrics. The record H1 deployment of €1.6 billion has driven growth in the fee per earning NAV of 62% from €2.8 billion at the end of June 2024, and 32% from $3.4 billion at the end of December 2024. NAV at the end of the period was €4.5 billion, with average H1 NAV of £3.3 billion. This growth in the fee-earning NAV has delivered growth in the discretionary fund management fee-related revenues of 66%, or £32.3 million to £80.9 million. It is clear to see the correlation between the NAV growth of 62% year-on-year and revenue growth up 66% year-on-year. Based upon a 10% co-investment level, the group targets capital-light returns of 30% on the capital invested by Arrow, broadly split 10% from fund management activities, 10% from asset management and servicing, and 10% from performance fees or carry. To date, we've not recognised any performance fees. Moving to slide 10, which summarises the results of the IFM segmental earnings, showing the split between the discretionary fund management and third-party asset management activities. As noted on prior earnings calls, the EBITDA derived from our discretionary fund management is a function of the average fee earning NAV of £3.3 billion. At the 30% margin on Arrow's co-investment that I explained a moment ago, and since we are not yet recognising any carry or performance fees, then the implied EBITDA for H1 is £33 million. The third-party asset management activity is typically at a 15% EBITDA margin, and therefore the implied EBITDA is £12 million, based upon the revenues of £83 million. In addition, there is the ongoing investment drag of circa £5 to £6 million during H1 as we continue to scale operations and certain activities are not yet fully at the required operational leverage. The investment drag is slightly higher than previous quarters, in part due to the impact of timing of certain ALO fees, which are slightly more back-end loaded. These three component parts help to understand the overall IFM EBITDA of £39 million delivered during H1 2025. Given we generate fees on deployed capital and there is upfront investment in people and systems to build fundraising and investment capabilities, there is an inherent lag between the current deployment and the build of the income streams. Slide 21 in the appendix that I have discussed on prior earnings calls demonstrates the expected build in capital-light revenue streams based upon continuing to deploy at current levels. Based upon annual deployment volumes of €3 billion per annum, then the expected steady-state IFM fee-related earnings and carry is targeted to be over £235 million per annum, compared with the current £39 million in H1 2025, demonstrating the strong earnings growth expected over the coming years. Turning now to the results for the balance sheet segment shown on slide 11. This segment reflects the investment returns of the back book investments, along with the returns generated on our co-investments in our discretionary funds. EBITDA for H1 2025 was $29 million, some $4 million lower than prior period, predominantly due to one-off Concordato income on certain Italian portfolios arising in Q1 2024 and not repeated in 2025. The realizations performance during H1 was $120 million, representing 111% of expectations. Q2 realizations were $69.7 million and represented 100% of expectations. Full-year realization expectations are circa $270 million, consistent with the position reported at Q1, and includes realizations over the second half of $149 million. Balance sheet investments increased by $100 million during H1 to $806 million, driven by the record H1 deployment. Our co-investment levels continue to reduce, with typical co-investment in ACO1 at 25%, reduced to 10% in ACO2, and reduced further to 7% in ALO. I expect future funds, in particular ACO3, to have co-investment levels below 10% and more in line with ALO. Slide 12 shows the overall result, together with the group segmental performance. Group costs primarily relate to the centrally controlled overhead costs and were $20.3 million for H1, broadly consistent with the run rate during H2 2024 of $19 million. And for H1 2025, the run rate during Q2 was also consistent with the run rate in Q1. Group costs are higher than prior year by $4.6 million, reflecting the scaling of the business over the previous 12 months, with the launch of the lending fund, the expansion into new jurisdictions, and as such, there has been a build in the talent and capabilities leading to the growth of group costs to the consistent run rate seen over the past 12 months. This has enabled the record deployment in H1 and the build of capitalized earnings. The current level of group segmental cost is reflective of a business now scaled to deliver deployment volumes of circa $3 billion per annum without any need for significant cost increase. The full underlying income statement is also shown on this slide. Overall, the loss before tax, adjusting items and non-cash foreign exchange has widened by $14.4 million to $23 million. Along with the segmental results that I have explained, the result has been impacted by the increased finance costs, primarily due to the refinancing completed in late 2024. Finance costs have risen by $9.3 million to $62.9 million. In addition, and as reported in prior periods, as the group grows its euro income, predominantly due to the growth in management fees and in due course carried interest in our funds, the group is maintaining a net euro liability position. The retranslation of this liability position gives rise to some non-cash P&L volatility and was a $32.2 million loss in H1 2025 against a gain of $3.6 million reported in H1 2024 with a year-on-year variance of $35.7 million. I would emphasise that maintaining a net euro liability position provides an economic hedge against the group's exposure to euro FX movements, given the future euro income growth, but does lead to some near-term non-cash P&L volatility. Moving to slide 13 and the detailed breakdown of the free cash flow generation, given the significant level of deployment in the first half, there has been an outflow with portfolio investments exceeding free cash flow generation by $100.4 million. This compares with an uplift in the level of balance sheet investments of $100 million. Typical co-investment levels are reducing 7% for ALO from 10% in ACO2, with an expectation that future funds will have co-investment levels of below 10% and closer to the level of ALO. Therefore, as we scale deployment volumes, the euro equivalent level of our co-investment will not increase at the same pace. As our integrated fund management fee-related earnings continue to build, alongside disproportionately reduced investment requirements, the free cash flow generation will continue to deliver sustainable deleveraging of the balance sheet. Moving to slide 14, which shows our leverage and funding position. The group's liquidity position and funding base are strong, with maturities now pushed out to 2029 following the refinancing completed in Q4 2024. The position has been further strengthened with the execution of a bond tap in June 2025, raising an additional 150 million euros, with liquidity headroom growing to 306 million as at June 2025. During Q2 2025, the group repaid the stub euro floating rate notes, and the current liquidity headroom is significantly above the remaining stub of the existing fixed rate bonds of 71 million due in 2026. Leverage has reduced by 0.5 times since 2021, the date of the take private transaction, and by 1.2 times over the past 12 months. There has been an increase to 4.3 times since the year end, predominantly due to the 180 million increase in net debt. And net debt has risen primarily as a result of the strong deployment, with our co-investment amounting to 138 million in H1 2025. In addition, there has been a 41 million increase due to the movement in the foreign exchange rate I detailed earlier, and 36 million working capital outflow, predominantly arising in Q1 2025 and caused by the payment of annual bonuses, the payment of bond refinancing fees, and increased accrual income driven by the record deployments. The capital-light business model continues to deliver sustainable deleveraging. It is also important to highlight that the leverage calculation uses adjusted EBITDA in the denominator of the calculation. Therefore, equal weighting is given to £1 worth of discretionary fee-related earnings as it is to £1 worth of realisations, which clearly requires an upfront investment of circa 60 pence to generate. Our capital-light model leaves us well-placed to continue to expand our integrated fund management proposition across credit, real estate and lending, in turn further driving fee-related earnings growth without placing strain on our balance sheet and facilitating sustainable deleveraging towards the strategic leverage commitment of 3 times. Thank you, and I'll now hand back to Zach.
Thank you, Phil. So closing out on page 16, you see our focus, both in terms of operational delivery and in terms of business model flow through, is really continuing to drive the LP franchise. The two main things you'll see in coming quarters there are final close of ALO and first close of ACO3. On the investment side, deploying those core funds has led to good progress, and you'll continue to see that. We're very happy now with our geographic footprint and with the product capabilities we have, and so it's really sweating that infrastructure, as Phil's talked about in recent slides. That then obviously drives a strong focus on cash collection, which we've always had. All the funds are measured in the same ERC formats that you've become accustomed to over the many years we've been a public issuer. And we drive to that same cash versus ERC internally on the realized side, which obviously benefits both the funds as well as obviously by stapling with our co-invest the corporate's denominator in cash realizations, and therefore we drive value as that capital flywheel accelerates, obviously the 29% growth year on year evidence is that strongly and deployment being the leading indicator, you'll see that growth rate increase as the deployment drives NAV, which then drives fees. And then obviously carry will kick in as we get to that phase, as you can model out, given the successful distributions out to ACL1. And obviously that'll repeat itself in future funds. And so, yeah, it is definitely a more of the same quarter with some pleasing fundamentals flowing through the system. And as we drive, you know, raising capital, investing capital, and realizing capital, which is the mantra we drive across the business, we expect to see that progress continue in coming quarters. And with that, look forward to answering your questions. So, George, back to you for Q&A, please.
Thank you very much, Ms. Louie. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, if you have any questions, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad, and just make sure that your lines are not muted in order to let your signal reach your equipment. So star 1 for questions. Our very first question is going to be coming from Ryan Fluke, calling from PVTL Point. Please go ahead. Your line is open. Ryan, could you please ask your question? Your line is open, sir.
Oh, sorry, guys. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Yes.
Perfect. Sorry about that. Thanks for agreeing to take the question and for the call. Just a quick one for me, if I may. Can you guys comment on how you see the leverage evolution going into next quarter? Obviously, Q3 and 24 was a particularly high collections point in the year, so that will roll off. So just any further color would be great.
Yeah, shall I say that? I mean, I think I'll probably reiterate things that I said during the presentation. I think it's important that we are building to a sustainable deleveraging position with the growth in capitalized earnings. And as you rightly point out, you know, Q3 2024 was a significant collections year, a significant collections quarter, and therefore you should expect to see leverage uptick from the current level of leverage. I expect that will go to, I think previously I'd sort of said I expected it to go to high fours. I think it will go higher than that, and that's really as a result of really two factors compared with where I previously guided towards leverage, and that's really the strong deployment that we've had during the first half of this year, which has led to that increase in net debt that I referred to, and then also the impact of foreign exchange rates, which has clearly led to that. You know, 41 million increase over H1 in terms of net debt. So I do think it will go higher than the high fours that I previously referred to.
Great, that's really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. We'll now move to Varshit Upalapati, calling for Partners Group. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Max Watson from Partners Group. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Hi, Max.
Hey, Phil. Thanks for the presentation. I guess just in the context of probably Q3 looking relatively weak year on year from the headline financial perspective, when can we expect a kind of more material fundraising update?
Yeah, I'll take that one. Obviously, I'd love to be as detailed as we can be. I mean, as you'll probably know, the SEC rules stop us kind of giving a blow-by-blow on a live fundraise on a public call. All I would just say is momentum is good, and if you look at our actions, if you look at the pace of deployment, we obviously feel confident that we're where we need to be. So, we'll obviously announce what we can as soon as we can.
Okay. And then just in terms of the IFM segment, it seems like the the investment drag was up year on year, and I think potentially quarter on quarter as well. And then you also had group costs up year on year, as you guys mentioned in the presentation. Just in terms of kind of that overall investment in the cost base and the new platform, are we kind of at a run rate level now?
Yes. So certainly on group costs, we've been at broadly speaking 10 million a quarter now for the previous last four quarters, and you've seen that over all of those quarters, there's been a relatively consistent and elevated level of deployment from compared with the first half of last year, and so. This level of cost base, of group cost base, is right sized to deliver the broadly speaking that 3 billion of euro volume per annum. On the investment drag side, on the IFM side, yeah, it's been slightly elevated in this quarter. I think. There's clearly, as we get to operational leverage, we are in the first sort of stages of ALO, and we do have a number of newish platforms, and therefore we're not quite at the operational leverage that we were with ACO, and so therefore, particularly with the sort of the slight profile of some of the ALO fees that's led to that increased operational increased investment drag, but I expect that to reverse as we get to more maturity and higher operational leverage.
Okay, thank you. And then just one final one. So on the third party asset management segment within IFM, it looks like the revenues there were down year on year relatively heavily in Q2, and the EBITDA was also down as well, so I think about 6 million. Could you maybe just provide some colour on what's going on there? I know there's often a few different moving parts within that segment.
Yeah. I mean, it really is as a result of the switch from Maslow primarily providing volumes to third party clients. So if you think about, all of their origination was and all the fees associated with that origination were in that third party asset management segment, because they were introducing deals to third parties. Now with the launch of ALO during the second half of last year, all of that income is now being captured within the discretionary fund management segment. So there's no, I guess the underlying revenues haven't been lost; they're being captured within the discretionary fund management segment with the launch of ALO.
Okay, I think it's about 6 million of EBITDA for Q2, and I think it was a similar amount in Q1. Is that kind of reflective of the run rate that we should expect for the remainder of the year, or is there still a kind of Maslow effect that needs to be worked through?
You'll see the Maslow effect in Q3 because ALO wasn't live then you'll see that Q4 will be at a similar level to last year. So,
Okay. Thank you, Phil. And definitely the fundraising efforts.
Yeah. Thanks, Max.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's your question, sir. We'll now move to Joanna Saw calling from UBS. Please go ahead. Joanna, your line is open. Hey, Joanna, we cannot hear you now.
Hi, can you hear me?
Oh, we can hear you now.
Hey.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Thanks. Hi. Just given the deployment is so important to your NAV, how have you maintained the talent you've acquired through the different asset managers over the last few years?
That's correct. I mean, your input statement is correct. There's no doubt that running the investment teams is core to mission. We've built, I'd say, two things that differentiate us and make that effective. The first is that, unlike other asset managers who have a big London office in Europe and drive centralized investment activity, we are the opposite extreme, right? We have 24 platforms which are local to Europe and operate in far less competitive cities. So, you know, our centers of gravity are in the 8 Western European countries where we operate and at the local level. And so, well, I'm not saying other managers don't have local offices. I mean, we have a total headcount in the thousands in that format. And so we are the extreme version of bottom-up local origination. And that means that we're competing for talent in, you know, Milan and Dusseldorf and Berlin and Lisbon and Amsterdam and Dublin and so on, as opposed to competing for talent in Mayfair in the same proportions. And then secondly is that from a asset manager perspective, we've built what I would describe as a currency wallet, which is interesting for team members, right? If you've got carry in ACO1, ACO2, soon to be ACO3, you've got carry in ALO1, AREO1 and 2, plus shares in a private equity-owned asset manager on top of base and bonus. You build up a very valuable, diversified, multi-currency performance security, which has both good running cash experience as well as various capital events on both the Topco and carry side. But when you combine those two features of the business model and you wind up with that currency wallet deployed in local cities that generally are not as asset manager dense as London, you know, it's not many jobs in, you know, pick a city in Lisbon where you can get carry in a handful of funds plus top co-equity plus base plus bonus. And so that combination of features make us really an employer of choice. It's a very compelling employer value proposition to our investment teams. And so we've been in a really strong place in terms of talent retention as opposed to that being an issue.
Great. And given you can't speak about, you know, how fundraising is going, could you outline how big you intend ACO3 to be, for example, and when do you intend to, you know, close up, I mean, like, stop fundraising for that fund and move on?
Yeah. So as a general rule, we have worked with our investors over time to set a general paradigm that says that the fund should be sized to correlate with kind of effectively last year's origination times 3. So why do we say that? The investment period of our funds is 3 years from final close. And so if you were underwriting us in a fund investor format, you would want to see that, you know, why do we think we can deploy the funds that we are raising? Well, it's because we did it last year. We just have to do the same as last year 3 more times. Be careful in how you kind of model that, though, because remember that the fund recycles for the first 3 years of its life. So in other words, we wouldn't, just to make sure we're not talking past each other, if, for example, just for simple math, if last year's origination was $1 billion, the fund wouldn't be $3 billion because you'd have to recycle as well. I mean, that would assume you spend all the money once, and as you've seen from the presentation, we've deployed ACO1 about 1.5 times, and we've deployed ACO2 more than 1.3 times so already. So that's how we do it. I can't, again, given it's a live product in the SEC rules, I can't tell you exactly what that translates to, but it's obviously a nice – I mean, if you've seen deployment up more than 100% period on period, you can obviously see the fund is getting larger, as is the franchise. So again, as soon as we can, we'll give you full details, and we've made nice progress and good momentum towards that outcome. Your second question around how long we fundraise for, I think ACO2, we fundraised in 9 months from first close to final close. The franchise is bigger and deeper and has more embedded re-ups than it had in prior periods. We've also done a really nice job in the fundraising team, where we've taken that entire function in-house. I mean, part of the overhead increase was to take that in-house. For those of you who've run these kind of funds, that is a long-term cost saving, but not in chronology sense. And what I mean by that is placement agents will charge you effectively for raising the fund, and then they'll charge you on re-ups. If you take it in-house, you obviously make that cost permanent and fixed, but then re-ups are free in terms of there's no echo fee to third parties for re-ups. And therefore, it, as you scale and your franchise strengthens, there's no doubt that's the right business approach to take that capability in-house. What's been nice in our case is that that team started going in-house in 2023, and so they've had a two-year clean runway to get ready for ACO3. And so this time around, there's no placement agent cost whatsoever, and they've had a running start at it. So it took us 9 months last time. I'd be optimistic we're in good shape to do well again.
Great. That's all good for me. Thank you.
Thank you much for your questions, Joanna. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, if you have any questions or follow-up questions, please press *1 at this time. We'll now move to Neil Simpson of ICG. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my question. Most of them have been answered, but just a follow-up to Max's question on the third-party servicing revenue. Are you able to split out what the – are you able to give me a year-on-year growth of revenues excluding the Maslow effect?
It would be broadly flattish, I would expect. I can follow up with a precise number, Neil. But broadly speaking, I'd expect it to be flattish without that effect. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. And then second, how has the fundraising environment for real estate equity evolved? I'm just curious because I know that's been a tough product to sell.
Hey, Neil. I'll take that one. So basically, I'd say I'll do the three step by step. I mean, ACO fundraising environment is very strong, both because I think credit is still an area of positive focus for people, and I'd say that Europe in particular has got a tailwind. A bit from American investors, but particularly places like Canada, some other strong allocator markets who have historically chosen to be underweight Europe, who are now very active in correcting and rebalancing that, and so that's been helpful. On lending, same fundamentals. I think lending is a slightly different issue in the sense that there's definitely an awareness within an investor base that real estate lending is something they should have as a diversifier from corporate exposure, and certainly a diversifier from the exit cycles that drive some elements of corporate exposure. And so what we see there is encouraging in that for a number of them, their assessment of people like us is really a question of basically, you know, is this a core holding we want to add to our portfolio where we want more credit and lending, but we want it to be in asset-backed activities as opposed to corporate exposure. And so given we've got a pan-European real estate lending footprint, which very few asset managers have, you know, I think, I mean, you saw the Adya announcement last year. I think some key investors have worked with us to put in place what is, I think, a scalable and core allocation for them. And hopefully as that sector is obviously fundamental to the economy and deep, as that allocation choice expands over time in investors' portfolios, we'd really hope to grow that. And I think if you were to roll the clock 5-10 years forward, you'd hope that the potential scale of ALO is frankly bigger than ACO. On real estate equity, look, that's been tough, I'd say. For a couple reasons. One is I think it's a shrinking pool globally. Obviously, real estate equity in a number of categories was a substitution for fixed income in prior cycles. As rates have gone up, it's had a double whammy hit on real estate equity allocations. It's, as you'll know, Neil, it's obviously made credit more comparably attractive whilst making being the equity in real estate comparably less attractive. And so that has quite a significant double down, if you will. We think it's important to have the franchise for that exact reason, that just to make sure you never have a completely good day at the office. I think it is the reality of the world that in a low-rate environment, real estate equity will fundraise easier, and in a high-rate environment, real estate debt will fundraise easier, and they are just two opposite sides of the same relative value equation. And so we're at a moment where, obviously in the Eurozone, that moment might be shifting, but up till now, we've been in a moment, certainly in the UK, and in US mindsets, where lending and credit should take the lead, and real estate equity is less attractive. I'd say two final things on that. One is that investors actively assess that. I mean, that's a live dialogue in a whole number of accounts, and people want to get their timing right on that issue. And so they know they need to act kind of ahead of the curve as opposed to behind the curve on that. And so, you know, we run both programs. We talk to investors about both programs. I'd expect to see inflows to one program or another dominate based on where we are in the macro, but we keep those dialogues live. And then two is that, you know, some of our strongest relationships have continued to put new money into that program, and the market opportunity for that program is really interesting. I do think that there are situations where some of the higher rates have created dislocations. So in kind of opportunistic and value-add elements of that real estate equity, you have good deployment shots. And so we'll continue to focus on that. Having said all of that, when you know, when we do the year-end call and you kind of see where we landed on the different products, I mean, there's no doubt that the material increases will be on credit and lending, not on real estate equity.
No, that's a super helpful overview. And just as you look forward maybe a year from now with, if you get ACO3 fundraise that's behind you, will you be able to fundraise the next iteration of ALO, or how do you think about what fills the pipe after ACO3?
We have a very clear plan on that, but it's hard for us to say it publicly in this form.
Okay.
What I would say is that two things will happen. Let me try and be as clear as I can. One is we will set up a recurring schedule where ACO, ALO, and ARIO rotate through, and as per the prior answer, we won't be able to rely at this stage on ARIO being in the billions the way ACO and ALO is. So your question's spot on in terms of there's a gap in that sense. Part of that gap could be filled by ALO reloading sooner. It's deployed very well. And that's possible, but we're acutely aware that it'd be a stronger franchise, given the 3-year investment periods of the different funds, to have another string to that bow. And we've been working on that in a thoughtful way that I think the market will appreciate. We do run, I don't think we've emphasized them on these calls, we've run ancillary strategies, as we call them, which are effectively LP clubs. So they're not discretionary big commingled vehicles, but they're LP clubs. And what that means is they, we will get a handful of LPs to commit to a strategy. It will come with a dedicated member or two or three of our team who runs that activity, and they don't have, in whilst they're in club form, the same GPLP economics. I mean, they'll have some degree of management fee and some performance fee, but they're not they're not greater than 100 basis point management fee kind of territory. The challenge for us is for one of those kind of LP clubs to graduate into being a fully fledged discretionary fund of size that can add to the product category. We don't want to pay, meaningful goodwill to build that. We think we're big enough with ACO and ALO that kind of ancillaries can mature and get promoted into discretionary funds coming through those franchises. And so we're working on that. We agree with where the question's coming from in terms of that being the forward role of what we need to do to get to a balanced pipeline so that we always have something for the fundraising team and the investor base to focus on, and we deepen and widen in a way that's accretive. And we'll announce what we can do there as soon as we're ready. But we're on that.
Okay. No, that's clear. Last question for me. To the extent you can discuss what's going on with DDM or Achilles, like I can probably infer what's going on, but just anything you can say on the call?
Obviously, it's reasonable to say that any of those bond trades we've done in that form are ACO deals. I think obviously you'll be familiar with some of the past practice we've done there. I think it's reasonable to infer similar directions of travel, but
okay.
Kind of obviously the live situation means we can't be more specific.
Understood. Okay. Thanks. That's all for me.
Thanks, Neil.
Thank you much, sir. Our next question will be coming from Zachary Schwab, calling from UBS. Please go ahead.
Hello. Hi, guys. Hi, Zach and Phil. This is kind of a feedback stroke, a question. High yield bond markets are quite short termist, so it's difficult for a lot of external people, maybe people not on this call, to think about ACOs in 5 years' time, like you suggested, 10, 15 minutes ago. And what they will do is think about this re-leveraging that Phil outlined, and they'll start, selling your bonds and punishing your bond structure. And you guys know this because you've been through it over the last 10 years as well in previous bond structures you've had. So it's kind of feedback, but it's also a question. What are you going to do to show de-leveraging? And this might be in your presentations. It just might be discussing it with investors. But you do need to do this. To prevent your bonds being dumped and your cost of capital just to go to a little bit fragile areas, but you're not going to be happy, and your whole tone of future conversations will be different if you don't nip this leveraging, re-leveraging in the bud, clearly, to investors.
Shall I take that? I mean, I think actually the leverage calculation becomes less meaningful for Arrow as we've gone through this transition. And actually, when we did the refinancing at the back end of last year, and obviously the bond tap we've just done, I think bondholders absolutely understand that, and there is, I guess, broad support for the transition that's going on, and that I guess there's two ways of looking at the issue. The first is basically, okay, looking at the leverage calculation, because clearly the denominator includes a growing capital light income, which you're not having to pay for. It's pure EBITDA rather than collections, which clearly, you know, includes the principal repayments, and therefore you're having to pay for. So, I do think that the bond market does fully understand that, you know, investing in the franchise now to build that capitalized earnings, which come through on a more progressive annuity-like basis, is well understood, and you can, you know, you can model that forward. And I think generally when I look at bondholders' models and you know, the models from people within the market, they you know, that aligns with the internal expectations. And then the second way that I think a lot of people looked at this at the time of the refinancing was not just on that leverage calculation, but looking at this on an enterprise value basis, and therefore looking at a more sum of the parts valuation of the business. In particular, at the multiples that you've seen many managers trade for on that, on an FRE sort of basis, and looking at the enterprise value of those revenue streams, and then comparing that obviously to the debt level, and you know, absolutely. You know, as an organization, we spend a lot of time, going through with bondholders and the market in terms of making sure that people understand that dynamic and understand the transition that's happening, and I think, you know, generally speaking, I think there's a good understanding, and as we've sort of said, you know, people should take away from this set of results that some of those lead indicators to the growth in that capitalized earnings, which is, you know, primarily the fundraising and then the deployment, and to get to a 3.1 billion LTM deployment is extremely pleasing. And I think generally the market understands that. But I completely agree. We will never rest, and we will continue to try and educate the market on those points.
I'd say, if I could just add one thing to that, I think that's a great articulation of the fundamentals and reflects the business trajectory correctly. I would also just say we've been a public issuer in this market for 13 consecutive years. We've been the same team through that. So I think we're acutely aware of, and have obviously lived through cycles and have gotten bondholder support through cycles, including tough times like COVID, et cetera, the take private, the refinance, things that were key to mission to go well. I sympathize a lot with what you're saying. I mean, the re-leveraging is not an attractive outcome. It's not what Phil and I want for the business. What I would say is that it's important to see that, and I know kind of preaching patient capital is probably not how public markets work in quite the same way as private markets, but what I would say is that the business moves in key fundamental moments, right? So closing ACO3 is fundamental. That's a serious move of the needle in terms of franchise scale and benefit. You know, obviously we've done disposals at various points in the past, which has brought leverage down dramatically. And so I think we're aware, whether it's in the denominator of driving cash flow or whether it's in the franchise progression of key events, that we've got to deliver. I think that message is on the front of our minds every day. And I have no intention of letting this drift in a manner that loses market confidence on the points that you're describing. Having said that, we also want to play for long-term value for frankly all stakeholders, including bondholders. And I think things like making a large deployment this quarter is unflattering to leverage levels, but it's obviously very important to the future flywheel of fee income. So we're on it. We do get it. We appreciate.
I think there's a few self-help measures you could do, which you already have them in your presentation. Is, for example, page 20, quite powerful, allows one to really think about, you know, what you were talking about, Zach, the 5 to 10 year plan. You know, highlighting this much earlier on. Often people don't even bother looking in the appendix, and they get nervous about the bond structure because they see re-leveraging or they hear it slightly further up. Certainly some rejigging you can do on the aesthetics just to make the story a bit more obvious to people who might not have the knowledge that it sounds like all people who've been asking questions do have. You know, because half the market obviously doesn't do the work and then attacks the bonds. Now, that isn't happening, by the way. It's just we all want to prevent that happening. And there will be some market participants referencing the re-leveraging, even though that is not the core part that drives the business, as obviously Phil explained very well. Anyway, you know, thanks for all the clear points and conversation.
No, appreciate that. And you know, we've been through those cycles where people have done that, and we've come out ahead on that process, and we're alive to the dynamic, and
yeah.
Obviously, we'll need to deliver key things as time goes on, but we see it the way you do. Let's just say it that way.
Thank you very much, sir. As we have no further questions at this time, Mr. Louis, I'd like to turn the call back over to you for any additional or closing remarks. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, George. Look, I think that's an accurate and good discussion on where we are. And yes, we look forward to future calls and to filling out, frankly, a number of the key points that you have been raised here. We feel confident that we've got good plans to address both the positive and the challenges that have been highlighted on this call, and look forward to chatting with you about them in November when we do Q3s. Thank you.
Thank you much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, that will conclude today's conference. We thank you very much for your attendance. You may disconnect. Have a good day and goodbye.